Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. My name is Alex Sears and I'm at the British Library in London today with my guest for this session, Jamie Andrews, who is Head of Modern Literary Manuscripts here. He's just edited and written an introduction to a book called Two Early Plays, which consists of a pair of the plays that John Osborne wrote before his so-called debut play, Look Back in Anger, whose production at the Royal Court in 1956 changed the history of British post-war theatre. The two plays, and they are The Devil Inside Him and Personal Enemy, both written in collaboration, the first with Stella Linden and the second with Anthony Crichton. As previously unavailable early works, these plays, which will be available from Oberon next month, cast an intriguing light on Osborne's influences and development. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Jamie Andrews.
Thank you very much.
Let's start at the beginning. When and how did you come across these two plays?
Yeah, well, very recently, actually. It started with research for an exhibition that the British Library put on last year called The Golden Generation, that was looking very broadly at the period 45 through 68 and looking at British theatre practitioners and the new institutions that developed in that time. And we wanted to look at familiar faces, but in a slightly fresh way. We wanted to acknowledge Osborne, we wanted to acknowledge his works, but we didn't necessarily want to tell the familiar story of 8th of May 1956 and that Big Bang breakthrough. So I was looking through his autobiography for a slightly fresh approach, and I noticed that he made very brief and incredibly scornful and disparaging references to the fact he'd written some work before 56. And I thought, okay, I wasn't actually aware of that. I think I'd fallen into the trap that everyone does, which is that because the whole New Wave project was about newness and freshness and vitality, that Look Back in Anger was his debut. Well, it wasn't, and he does make that clear in the autobiography if you look carefully. So I then looked at John Heltman's biography, which had just been published, I think, earlier that year, and looked for reference to this early play that Osborne mentions, The Devil Inside Him. And Heltman does mention it. It's basically drawn from what Osborne himself says in the autobiography, and Heltman concludes, but unfortunately the plays haven't survived, the plays have destroyed, which was exactly what Osborne said. And I remember actually reading this at night and thinking, ah, it's a shame, it's interesting. And then suddenly thinking, having this nagging feeling, that can't quite be right, because if these were written pre-68, and they were, then a copy would have had to be submitted to the Lord Chamberlain's office to ensure a licence for performance. And these plays were performed. Which made me think that since it was submitted to the Lord Chamberlain, it would have remained with the Lord Chamberlain, because that's what happened, and it would then have been transferred with the Lord Chamberlain's archive to the British Library. So the next day I came in and thought, well, let's just see if the plays are there. And lo and behold, The Devil Inside Him, 1950, the script was there.
Wonderful.
And the second play as well, Personal Enemy, also turned up. And so we displayed them in the exhibition. They attracted a lot of interest. And I talked to Gordon Dickerson, who represents the Osborne estate, who was incredibly enthusiastic and excited by this. And we both got together and agreed we should really publish them. They'd never been published up to this point. As I said, they were unknown. And so we thought there was a project around this.
And there's no manuscript version of them extant at all in the kind of John Osborne archives in the United States or anything like that?
It's famously the Osborne archive went to Texas, which was obviously something we might regret, but nonetheless it's a great archive. And so that was the next step, clearly, to go over there and see what was there. So I went over in November, I was in Austin anyway, for a conference and looked through. There's no reference at all to The Devil Inside Him, which was the early play written in 1948, performed in 1950, because by that point, in fact, there's very little information at all from that period. He just wasn't keeping any papers he was producing. There is a fragment in a notebook. The archive in Austin is full of notebooks, which veer wildly between extracts from which ended up in plays, personal diary entries, just little jottings. And there's an extract that, because I knew the play, I could identify as a very early draft, or fragment of a draft, of Personal Enemy, although it wasn't titled as such, which of course the cataloguers over there hadn't been able to identify because they didn't know it became this play.
Yeah.
But nothing else there. What there is, though, is the wonderful sequence of correspondence between Anthony Crichton and John Osborne. Osborne was often off on tour. He'd write back to Crichton, who was at home in London, in the home that they both shared in London. And it talks about all these plays that he's writing, and maybe we'll move on later to the fact that there were more plays than this. And those letters gave a great clue, both about the timings, when they were written, and also Osborne's feelings about them. Because there was one thing I was really concerned by. There's always a danger with the academic approach, which is you're digging up, you're kind of searching through people's dirty drafts drawer, you're digging up anything that was put there for a reason to be hidden. And I thought, well, what would he have thought of this? Is this the right thing to do? But it's clear when you look at the letters over there that both these plays, but particularly Personal Enemy, were really important to him. Obviously, once he made his breakthrough with Look Back in Anger, it was important not to point to any antecedents because he wanted to kind of ride that Big Bang approach. But at the time, he was he stood by these plays, he was proud of them, and he was desperately searching for theatres to put them on. So those kind of clues emerged from the letters over there, which obviously tallied with the actual plays we've got here.
Well, let's give a brief account of the first one, The Devil Inside Him, and then follow that with Personal Enemy. What's The Devil Inside Him about?
It's an intriguing and slightly mad mixture of all sorts of dramatic conventions. At one level, it's a well-made play with all the usual kind of hoary rep conventions. It is set in a single setting. It's a boarding house in Wales, South Wales, which is the country, of course, of Osborne's father. So there's some personal link there. And its main character is a typical Osborne outsider. It's a young boy, young Welsh lad called Hugh, who is imbued with oversensitivity, with poetic feelings, which of course in this village go completely unnoticed and are very much distrusted. Into this setting comes a precocious, flirty young servant girl, played by Osborne's lover at the time, actually, we'll come to that, but who has fallen pregnant by a shady travelling salesman straight out of the mousetrap, and who is looking for a solution to this. And the solution she finds is to set up a situation where it appears that Hugh, who is seen as this kind of poetic loon, as Osborne says, to set up the situation that he attacks her, that she falls pregnant as a result, and then that will be her kind of excuse or her her fallback for explaining how she's come to be pregnant. Now what happens is that Hugh actually, when he's faced with the reality that he realises that yet again he's been betrayed by the advances of this servant girl Dillis, he murders her, which sounds incredibly sudden, and of course it is incredibly sudden. You have an episode of Grand Guignol where he tries to dispose of the body with little bits all over the place. You don't actually see most of that on stage, but it's reported in the third act. And then it gets more serious, where the third act is it's an interrogation scene where the minister comes in, who is a very icy, repressive kind of emblem of all the repressive forces that are felt in the village. And he tries to accuse Hugh of the murder, which of course is correct, but in doing so tries to, I guess, make his ideas triumph, his very narrow-minded ideas triumph over Hugh's ideas of poetry and kind of wider horizons in the village. And it ends up with Hugh assuming the murder, but in the process also vanquishing the ideas of the minister. And so in many ways the minister is actually the loser, and Hugh, through acting and assuming the murder, opens up new horizons for himself, ironically, and he's able to in some ways break out of this isolation that he felt previously. So it's a very strange play. We talk about the language maybe later, but it's very overblown language. But there's also these kind of classic rep traits, and that I think comes from the collaborative nature of the project.
Yeah. So he wrote it with Stella Linden, is that right? And she was his lover at the time?
Yes. Yeah. She was the leading lady on a tour in 1948 that Osborne had been taking around the country. It was a number two tour of a play called No Room at the Inn, and Stella joined in the summer as the leading lady. She was married to Patrick Desmond, who was an impresario, who had been working actually in theatre since the 1930s, and he ended up working with the young Cameron Mackintosh in the 1960s. He was very much this kind of rep figure, who, with the disappearance, the decline of weekly rep, his days were numbered. But he was taking these tours around, and as I say, Stella Linden, his wife, appeared on scene. Osborne was infatuated with her. She seemed more interested in him as a writer than anything else, and Osborne got almost drawn into writing this play with her. And she was very scornful of anything that smacked of poetry or of highfalutin, fancy feelings or fancy language.
Is she the one that also said you need a lesson in Pinero?
Exactly. Yeah. And she was obsessed by structure. She wanted a well-made play. And so she took Osborne's initial draft, which was called Resting Deep, and between them, they tried to turn it into a classic rep play. And that's where you get the characters such as the Daffy Daly woman, who is constantly constantly talking. You've got this seductive servant girl, etc. And you've got this Grand Guignol element with hiding the body parts.
I find it really interesting that this is 1948 and 49, and we don't really associate extramarital affairs and all that, and yet it seems quite free, because apparently her husband accepted the situation. Is that right?
Or? Yes, there's two. I mean, this is the theatre, remember? So.
Yeah, yeah, of course. But still, you know.
There was one school of thought, which is that it was a marriage of convenience and that Patrick Desmond was gay.
Right.
It seems that it was slightly more fluid than that. Mm. But Patrick Desmond, whatever the truth, did seem remarkably accommodating. After the tour had finished, and after they'd written the play together, he actually set the two of them up in his flat in Brighton, and they spent a halcyon year there. This is 1949. Osborne living with Stella, trying to write a second play together, which never actually materialised. And Desmond all the time encouraging them, which is very strange.
Yeah.
And the odd conclusion to this is that Osborne's relationship with Stella fizzled out in 1949, but his relationship with Patrick Desmond actually continued through to 1955.
That's right, and he actually staged The Devil Inside
Him.
Yeah.
He had...
where was that? Huddersfield, was it?
Yes, yeah. He had a theatre up there, and he was putting on a six-show season, and one of the plays that he wanted to put on was The Devil Inside Him. And so he rescued, before that he'd actually got Osborne an ASM job in Leicester, and then he got him his first play, which seems remarkably accommodating given all that had happened.
Yeah.
But this was very much, my argument is that this was Osborne's first father figure, which of course has confusing Oedipal overtones if you think about the fact that he was sleeping with his wife. But still. Yeah.
But also later, I mean, George Devine arguably was a father figure.
And he talks about when Osborne found the royal court, he talks about coming home, about Devine being the father figure. Mm. But actually, I think that Patrick Desmond fulfilled a slightly similar role earlier on.
Okay, Personal Enemy. Mm. Now, that was co-written with a fellow rep actor, Anthony Crichton.
Mm.
And could you tell us the story of how that evolved? Because that was about 5 years later, I think.
Yes, Anthony Crichton, better known, actually, as the co-author, if he's known at all, he's better known as the co-author of Epitaph for George Dylan, which was also written before Look Back in Anger, but it was staged afterwards in 1958, very much in a kind of post-Look Back in Anger glow. Mm. So it was written with Crichton, who was his flatmate. They'd been wanting to write a play together for a while. And this was summer of 1954, and news about the McCarthy trials was all over England. And so they took this situation of a repressive political system in America, and they linked it very cleverly with the Red Scare and the Lavender Scare. The Red Scare, the fear of communists, the Lavender Scare, fear of homosexuals, and these ideas of political and sexual deviancy being linked, which was actually historically incredibly astute.
And also reflected the preoccupations of a lot of people in England, because I think in those years there was this massive campaign led by the Daily Express, or soon afterwards at least, you know, saying, oh, well, theatre's full of gay people, we need to hound them out. And at one point, John Gielgud was arrested and prosecuted.
I mean, it's very, and that very much linked, there was pressure. As Nick de Jong's new play that's on at the moment shows, there was, and a lot of studies have shown, there was a lot of pressure coming directly from the American administration onto the British government to try
Plague
and
over England,
deal, exactly,
plan,
try and deal with this issue. So it's, to my mind, a kind of European social realist engaged play is coming at the situation from a very engaged, almost propagandistic point of view, pointing out the inanity and the immorality of this persecution that was going on.
Yeah. And yet, strangely enough, it's set in sort of small town America.
Set in small town America. It's set in the summer of 1953, which was Sylvia Plath writes about a queer, sultry summer. It's the summer they electrocuted the Rosenbergs.
Oh, yeah, so the atom bomb spies. So
exactly,
cool.
Korea had just finished. America had withdrawn from Korea, not entirely satisfactorily. So there was a fear, and the word that reoccurs so many times is fear. There was a political fear and a social fear, and these were being linked in small-town America.
That's
with a fear
also
of homosexuality.
Interesting now, isn't it? Because we still live in a kind of culture of fear where there's fears of terrorism and fears of deviant sexuality, so-called, quite often being recycled by politicians.
Yeah,
especially
I mean, it's
right.
Absolutely. And these ideas of otherness were interesting. But what's particularly interesting, of course, this is John Osborne. Now, I think he's been unfairly tarnished because of certain statements he made, one of which is, thank God, I was born the two best things I could be, British and straight.
Yeah.
It's so much more nuanced than that. But nonetheless, he has got this reputation of being the kind of this Englishness that runs straight through him.
Mm.
And he's been accused, and I can see why, of a very suspect attitude towards homosexuality in some of his writings and some of his statements.
Oh, yeah, that's undoubtedly true, although usually a lot of those statements come from comparatively late in his career and his life, when he was rude about just about everything.
Exactly,
You know, apart from the Anglican Church,
You
know.
Which is not to forgive any of that, but I do think that, as you said, that's tarred his whole career.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, if his best friend, Anthony Crichton, was gay, And whether John Osborne was gay or not, or bisexual, or whatever these categories mean, he certainly had an intense friendship with Anthony Crichton, as far as I know. The letters they exchanged seem very quite personal, really.
That's interesting. When I was in Texas, I was looking at these letters, and I was wondering how far to go down this line of, oh, let's read everything to find out, was he really gay, wasn't he? And then after about 2 minutes, I realised that was so uninteresting. It really, what does it matter? But what did emerge from these letters is that in his early days with various rep companies, not just Crichton, but he formed very, very intense relationships with fellow male actors who clearly idolised him and adored him. And he had, he went along with that for a while, but then became worried when the feelings became too intense, which struck me that he probably wasn't having a physical relationship with these actors, but that there was a very close emotional bond there. But politically, socio-politically, he was very clear in his letters at this time to Crichton and others that what was happening, both in America and particularly in England, with the persecution, as you say, they're trying to root out homosexuals from the theatre, the Gielgud case, the Montague prosecution as well, which was taking place at this time. He was clear that this was absolutely abominable. Which came from two angles. Firstly, from a kind of social protest angle, but also from something which maybe rings true later in life with this invasion of privacy, that what business is it of the state to go meddling around in people's bedrooms or whatever, what people do in their private life. And he thought it was just absurd that that these prosecutions should ever happen. And so that's what I think the attitude, the kind of the situation in England, he's been codified a little by this depiction of small town America. He couldn't, he knew there was no way he'd get anything past the Lord Chamberlain if it was directly commenting on the situation in England. But by distancing it slightly, I think he still makes his points.
Now, Personal Enemy was staged in Harrogate in 1955, and once again, Desmond was crucial to that.
Exactly, still Desmond. To be fair, Osborne was trying it on absolutely every agent in town, in the same way that Look Back in Anger went around the shops. And Desmond wasn't his first choice. However, Desmond had read the play, and when it became clear that other theatres weren't going to take it on, he, I think it's fair to say, he settled for the Desmond production.
Now, you found both these plays in the archive of the Lord Chamberlain. Are there many marks or criticisms of particular points in the plays by the readers of the Lord Chamberlain?
Yes and no. It's The Devil Inside Him was passed almost without a fuss. There were few things around the edges, but basically he got away with it, and he remembers in his autobiography, and this is the one reference in the autobiography that alerted me to them, that he has his daily woman singing a song about, oh, I do love to play with your lovely snowballs, and he thought that was his cheeky little song that he got past the Lord Chamberlain. They didn't notice that. The Personal Enemy, very, very different story. There's two versions to what happened, but it seemed that he submitted the play, or that Patrick Desmond submitted the play, incredibly late for licensing. Desmond said, and this is rather surprising, he didn't realise he had to submit the play because it was an American play. Now, it was a play set in America, but it clearly wasn't an American play. Although Desmond was very canny, and he was advertising it around in the local newspapers as the European premiere of the American sensation Personal Enemy. And this is typically Desmond, this is the impresario side to him, trying to drum up interest by pretending it's this great American hit. And of course American plays were very much in vogue at the time. Anyway, he claimed that it was submitted late because it's an American play. In fact, American plays still had to be submitted. Clearly, to my mind, that shows that he was very nervous about whether it would pass, because the depiction of the sexuality of the two sons in this this apple pie American family is equivocal. It's not clear in any way about the homosexuality or about the sexuality, but there are certain key kind of descriptive terms which are used often as symbols of homosexuality.
So there's a mention of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass.
Well, that's really the apogee of it. It starts off with references to one of the sons has very long, silky, smooth hair. One of them is particularly keen on gardening, and there's a bizarre reference where it says, "I've never seen a man who gardens like you do," which is very odd. And very clean, delicate hands. It's those usual kind of terms which might tip one off. Clearly, there's this complex interplay of signifiers going on. which gradually gets increased. And when one of the younger sons has been given a book by an older librarian who is, we note, bookish and likes poetry, clearly danger signs, exactly. And the book happens to be Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman, then that's too much.
Yeah.
And what's interesting there is, of course, that the Lord Chamberlain's staff, readers, were constantly trying to second guess authors' authorial intentions.
Yeah.
That it was very easy to strike out a banned reference, but they were also having to think about what was being suggested.
Yeah.
And in this case, Leaves of Grass, and we've got an illustration in the book, blue line through it, that couldn't be used in the text,
That's really interesting that it's so explicit and you've got that reproduced. Yeah.
And then, so those are the individual points. But clearly, as I said, the play intriguingly links sexual and political deviancy.
Mm.
The political deviancy didn't worry the Lord Chamberlain's readers at all, despite the fact that it was a play that was showing up the repressive internal policies of Britain's wartime ally and still strong ally.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that there's mention of the Communist Party in a positive light, positive if cautious light.
Mm. And this is at the height of the Cold War.
Exactly. I mean, Korea's just finished, Rosenberg's, etc. But that didn't seem to worry them. What did worry them is that, and there's a comment in the Lord in the margin, where it says this could be political, not sexual. The implication being if it was political, it would be okay. If it was sexual, then they need to act.
Okay.
So it went up the chain, and this is the way the Lord Chamberlain's office worked. The person who initially read it was the reader, and then he would pass it up to the supervisor if there's a problem. It went up to the senior examiner, who comes up with this very bizarre statement, and he says, the perverted element, typical word, the perverted element seems to be a gratuitous addition to an anti-communist theme. There's two things that are of interest there. Firstly, he has very much picked out that there is depiction of homosexuality on stage, and that's not allowed. But he's so blinded by this depiction that he's completely misdiagnosed the play. It's not an anti-communist play. It's certainly anti-American government at the time, anti-McCarthy, anti-witch hunt. It's not anti-communist at all, but he's completely blown out of the water on that one, because he's focused on this depiction of the homosexuality. So the author, Osborne, and the producer Desmond were ordered or invited, because it was all very gentlemen, were invited into St. James's Palace to discuss the play. And the upshot of that was, Osborne remembers that he got blind drunk and the meeting didn't go well. Yeah. Desmond says that it was a lot more congenial. But whichever way it was, they were told they had to remove all references to the homosexual subplot, which meant you were just left with a slightly bizarre play where the motivations had to be explained purely by the political, and that didn't make sense.
You quote some reviewers of the original production who were actually a bit puzzled as to the plot points because of that sort of censorship.
That's interesting that the reviewers, the local reviewers, picked this up. The Harrogate Advertiser has a quote. They wondered if the narrative obscurity was, quote, perhaps because of the censor's hand. So there's an awareness there of an absence in the narrative, and that could have been as a result of censorship. And the stage talks about some confusion in the story, and clearly this was because they had 2 or 3 days to put the revised script into rehearsal. It was all done in a rush anyway. There was no way that you could
probably
salvage
actors
coherence.
Were dropping lines left, right and centre.
Exactly.
One of the marvellous things about publishing these two plays is that it really does show how Look Back in Anger has assumed the status of a myth. And I think you mentioned that John Osborne had written something like 7 plays before Look Back in Anger.
Yes.
And obviously we know about Epitaph for George Dylan, but there were various mentions of verse dramas in his notebooks and things like that. Could you just say a few words about that? Because it is fascinating how he didn't just spring to public attention out of nowhere. He was obviously somebody who was trying to find his own voice and had failed several times beforehand.
Yeah, and that's certainly what these two plays show. He hadn't found his voice. One of the reasons that Look Back in Anger worked was the demotic violence of the language that felt right for that time. In these two plays, he's got a social realistic committed work which doesn't quite get the American idiom, and he's got an overblown poetic work which, again, didn't work. So, but they were clearly, as you say, he was looking around for a subject and a voice. Now, I tried to add up the number of plays that he'd written before Look Back in Anger, and it's not easy to say. We know these two plays were written and performed. We know George Dylan, although Epitaph was actually performed in a very, very significantly revised version in 1958 from what he'd written in 1955. There was also a play that once he'd finished Look Back in Anger in June 1955, he had some free time. He knew it had been accepted for the court for the following season, but he still had 6 months. And so he set to work on a play which I've identified the title as being Love in a Myth.
Oh, yeah.
There's no trace of it, except that he writes in one letter later on that The World of Paul Slickey, which was the famous flop, the disaster, the musical, which was 1959, was based in some way in Love in a Myth, but we haven't yet found that.
The other thing that you point out, which is also fascinating for me, is the similarity of some of the themes. For example, the idea of being true to yourself, which seems to run through both these early plays, the idea of authenticity. And also, there is a tone of voice which you can sometimes identify as John Osborne. You know, in The Devil, when he says, and one of the characters says, "Have you ever seen a pig slaughtered?" I mean, that sounds a bit like Jimmy Porter already, doesn't it?
There's the violence, and that, the funny thing is, that's said at a very quiet, sedate dinner table with his two parents. It's not obvious table talk.
Yeah.
And brilliantly, the reply to that is from the puzzled father, who says, "Oh, why couldn't he have worked in an insurance office like his cousin?" But yeah, there's that use. The point of that is, it's the use of words as a weapon to wound. The other one of the other plays, which does exist, two-thirds of it exists, the two of the three acts exist. It's called The Great Bear or Minette.
That
charts the disintegration, the violent disintegration of a relationship. It charts the existence of a third person in the relationship in the triangle, who is a friend, very much on the lines of Cliff in Look Back in Anger. And it charts the way that the hero goes from his initial partner to another woman, then back to the initial partner, in a way that happens to Look Back in Anger. And that is written in free verse. So it's basically Look Back in free verse.
And it's interesting that all of these fragments reappear in some form later on in his work. It's as if after Look Back in Anger, he continues to mine stuff that he only imperfectly could write. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think people have... I certainly hadn't until I looked into this in the archive. I don't think people have quite realised how much of the seeds for his canonical work were in place by the time before Look Back in Anger was staged. And there's some good examples of this. In the notebook in which he's drafting or playing around with ideas for Personal Enemy, there's lines which seem familiar to me. They're kind of patter, essentially. And I thought, oh, what's that? And of course it's lines, it's Archie Rice's lines from The Entertainer. Some of them went straight into the play. I mean, not changed at all, which is incredible. There's also notes on Luther. I don't think at that point it had been made into any kind of dramatic form, but there's historical notes on Luther.
Yeah, so he's obviously interested in that as a subject.
And there's just little lines here and there which crop up. So not only was he shaping his ideas in his voice, but actually he was shaping subjects which he used.
And the other very interesting thing about both these two early plays is the fact that they are large cast, repertory, standard theatre, although however imperfect. He was already ambitious to write for a main stage. It's completely different to nowadays, when young writers start off either with monologues or with two or three characters, maximum five, because otherwise nobody's ever going to put it on. You know, that kind of thing.
Well, we're just adding up the characters before. I think there's nine in the first play, Devil Inside Him, and eight in Personal Enemy. But Personal Enemy, it's a fresco of American small-town society with investigators, shady investigators coming in from Washington, etc. It's a whole society that's been depicted. And the ambition that it takes to do that is really quite incredible. The first play, maybe slightly less ambitious in terms of the kind of social arena he's trying to cover, because it is very much a wee close situation with a house along the lines of a kind of classic Agatha Christie, whodunit, etc. But no, the ambition he was showing was really quite surprising, and also the fact that he was, you know, he was known for his depiction of Englishness, and yet he had influences coming in from all over the world.
Yeah, there's one set in Wales, another in the United States of America, and obviously collaborating with different people. That's a really good point.
And geopolitical themes that are he's engaging with that are circulating through.
And in fact, I suppose it's when he actually found his theme and voice, you know, definitively, and looked back in anger, the idea of failure and the idea of Englishness and so on, that he really takes off. But we should perhaps also mention that your book there has a preface called Look Back at Frinton, by Peter Nichols, which evokes this lost world of theatre in the 1950s. Can we talk a little bit about this? I mean, it's amazing how much local and small-scale theatre there was, because at Frinton, I believe it was a kind of summer theatre.
Yes, it was the summer season. Both Peter and John were there for four weeks. Peter, in his foreword, writes that Osborne would potentially have been there for less than 4 weeks because he was on the point of being sacked if it hadn't been for the fact that Peter Nichols stuck up for him and said he was an interesting character. And so they were both retained. Oh. Now, the audience is interesting, of course. They were playing farces. They both played together and See How They Run. Osborne also played in An Agatha Christie, which is now called And Then There Were None. It was those kind of plays played for, I think, disinterested holidaymakers or semi-interested holidaymakers, which for an aspiring actor who was writing much more interesting plays must have been relatively frustrating. On the other hand, what a learning ground. Not only were you playing a new play every week, you're also coming up against or playing with really key people who would go on to shape British theatre. There's a reference in one of the biographies that not only did John Osborne play with Peter Nichols and Michael Blakemore, which we know about, that he also crossed paths with Harold Pinter. And I've been looking into that from both their biographies. I can't see what play that could have been that they were both in. But anyway, there's a rumour that they both played together.
That's interesting. Now, apparently in Frinton, it was a very select little resort, shades of Aunt Edna from Terence Rattigan, I think. And obviously Osborne was very scornful about the people there, and he said it was the type of place where the Radio Times was kept in an embossed leather cover, which I think is great. But also with Anthony Crichton, didn't they set up the Saga Repertory Company?
Yes.
Which was sort of barely legal. I've forgotten, where was that? Ilfracombe.
And then they took it to Hampshire.
And I think they didn't pay tax or...
What they did do, though, is funny. There's a lot of letters written on a Saga Company headed paper.
They
didn't get their finances sorted out, but they did get the headed paper, which is clearly seen as like the first crucial step. Osborne, it's very difficult to tell because it's only Osborne's retrospective take in this that survives. I couldn't find many letters written actually at the time about this company, but it seems that they weren't paying the taxes and essentially they just did a runner and defaulted on their obligations. But that's interesting as well. But it's this kind of entrepreneurial, it's a horrible word, but there was this entrepreneurial spirit that Osborne was so engaged with the theatre that he'd do anything it took to get the plays on and to be in the plays. And if that meant some kind of shoddy semi-legal company which had to
relocate. Also, it's that kind of British thing of can do. Do-it-yourself theatre.
Yeah, and the thing about Osborne's letters at the time are 80% despairing of ever finding good roles, despairing of being able to put his plays on. It's very clear at the same time that he's absolutely loving this milieu. He loves being amongst actors. So I think it was love-hate, but I think he retrospectively made this period seem an awful lot more gloomy than it necessarily was at the time for him.
Great. I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much, Jamie.
Thank you very much.